So I'm not Catholic.
Oh, where are you then?
I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Oh!
Have you heard of them?
Yeah. Mormons, right?
Yeah, but we don't go by Mormons. Yeah, because we don't want to take Christ's name out of the church.
Does that mean a Mormon doesn't call themselves a Mormon?
Not anymore. They advise us to correct that now.
Ooh, who's they?
Our prophet.
Who's your prophet?
President Nelson.
Oh, he's like the Pope of the Mormon Church.
Yeah, we have a Latter-day prophet.
No, yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I meant. Latter-day, my bad.
Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Amber Khan. You can learn more about different religions by watching the full video from which we just heard an excerpt. It was made by a Seattle-based production company called Cut, which asked young people to guess the religion of other young people they had never met. It's fun to watch, but it also reveals how little we Americans know about each other's faith. A survey from Pew Research Center proves it. This summer, the center released its 32-question religious knowledge survey. Most adults could not even answer half the questions correctly and scored even worse when it came to religions other than Christianity. So today, we're talking about what Americans know and don't know about each other's religions and the consequences of ignorance. Those consequences can be minor and embarrassing, hence the awkward moments in the clip we just heard. But not knowing much about religion can also lead to fear, scapegoating, and political manipulation, which can lead to violence. And in America today, hate crimes against minority religious groups are on the rise. FBI numbers leave no doubt. Anti-Muslim crime spiked more than 90% between 2014 and 2016. And anti-Jewish crimes rose more than 37% in 2017, the most recent year available. Today, we hear from three people who each take a distinct and thought-provoking approach to the problem of religious illiteracy. First up, Ben Marcus of the Washington-based Religious Freedom Center. He travels around the country showing schools how to teach their students about the world's religions without crossing church-state lines. I began by asking, how did he become an evangelist for religious literacy?
Well, I don't know if you want my whole life story, but it goes back to my parents, actually. My mom is a Roman Catholic. My dad is a humanist Jew, which means he's Jewish, but theologically an atheist. So I grew up with both of those. There was productive tension in my family about religion. Perhaps somewhat surprisingly to some people, I had a bar mitzvah and first communion. So in order to prepare for both of those.
You had a multi-faith family experience.
Right. To prepare for those, I had to go to Sunday school and Saturday school, and that's where I learned about religion. My parents talked about religion, but not in any enormous depth, and so it wasn't until I got to college that I did this really deep study.
And so here you are today, a religious literacy specialist.
Yeah.
And so the Pew study, I know that this is not the first time that they've done the religious literacy survey.
That's right.
And tell me about what and how Pew's work influenced your study.
Sure. So the first study was conducted in 2010. There's only been two. And that first 2010 U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey also asked 32 questions. They were slightly different questions. Some of them were completely different. And on that first Pew U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey, on average, Americans could answer 50% of those questions correct. At the time when the study came out, I was in college. I was a religious studies concentrator with a focus on religious literacy, and I wanted to write my thesis about this survey. While I was considering what it meant to write about the survey, what angle I would take, I was reading Stephen Prothero's book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. That came out in 2007. And Steve Prothero was a key advisor to the Pew Research Center on the U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey. And in his book, a groundbreaking book, New York Times bestseller in 2007, he defines religious literacy as primarily about scriptural narrative and doctrine. And if you take a look at that study in 2010 from Pew, a lot of the questions that they were asking were about scriptural narrative and doctrine. And what was very surprising to me, under the mentorship of a professor at Brown University named Thomas Lewis, was he was getting me to think about what it meant that Americans, who on average are quite religious, especially compared to other developed or Western European countries, for example, are very religious people overall, and yet they weren't answering 50% of the questions correct on the U.S. Religious Knowledge Survey. So the question that Professor Lewis led me to was to ask whether the kinds of religion that people were experiencing in their own lives, what they meant by "I am a religious person," was the kind of thing that we were testing on the survey. If religious people can't answer questions correctly about religion, then perhaps the kinds of religion that we're asking them about just aren't the kinds of religion that they care about in their own lives.
Why is that important? Why is it important for us to get the answer to that question?
It's important if we care about preparing people to live in an increasingly religiously diverse country in which they're having conversations with their neighbors about their religious identities, in which they're prepared to grapple with living with our deepest differences. So if we think that religion is about belief primarily, if it's primarily about scriptural narrative and doctrine, then the tendency is when we meet someone of a religious tradition that we're unfamiliar with, we ask them about their religious identity through the lens of scriptural narrative and doctrine. We ask them, what do you believe?
So you're kind of interrogating the ideas that Pew and Prothrow have put forward, and you emerge with a different point of view. What's your point of view?
Sure. So my point of view was then informed by a small-scale study I did in Providence, Rhode Island. I was working with a group of Catholics at the time. When I asked them to talk about religion in their own lives, they weren't just talking about belief. They were talking about their connection to their community. They were talking about celebrating certain holidays with their family. They were talked about connections to social values and ethics. And so at the center, when we talk about the construction of religious identity, what we really talk about is not just belief, but also behaviors, the things that we do inside sacred settings and outside sacred settings, and also our communities of belonging. And that means not just what we say when we say, I'm a Muslim or Christian or Jew or Buddhist or Hindu or atheist, but also our racial, ethnic, familial, gender, and other identities that intersect with our religious identity and our religious community of belonging. So what that means for interreligious dialogue or engaging with the religious other is that I might be someone who's religious and that religious identity is primarily grounded in the community that I belong to or my behaviors, the things that I do. And the person that I'm talking to might primarily ground their religious identity in their beliefs and in the things that they do. And so instead of talking about beliefs, which is not something that we both primarily ground our identity in, we can agree that behaviors are important for both of us. And so the type of dialogue that we have is much richer for actually talking about something that is that we're personally invested in.
And that kind of experience that you're describing, that setting of two people with maybe different belief systems or coming from two different belief traditions, or maybe even the same.
Right.
And what they discover is their practices may be the same or different, and that the label of the community that they are, the tradition that they are identifying with, is not necessarily the singular defining glue.
Right. That's an excellent point, and one I try to make elsewhere, which is you can be in the same church, for example. When I conducted this study, it was a Catholic church. In that same church, there were clearly respondents who constructed their religious identity about belief. When I asked them the top four most important parts of their Catholic identity, they talked about belief in Jesus as the Son of God. They talked about the nature of the Trinity. They talked about a personal relationship with Christ. For another person in that same church, when I asked them about what was most important to you about being a Catholic, they didn't rank belief in Jesus even in the top four most important parts of their identity. They talked about celebrating certain holidays. They talked about rites of passage, like going to a Catholic church for marriages or baptisms or funerals. They talked about this connection to their heritage as Italian Catholics or French Catholics or Irish Catholics or Portuguese Catholics. In that same church, there were people who were calling themselves Catholic, some of whom were calling themselves Catholic because they believed in certain doctrinal or theological things, and some of whom were calling themselves Catholic because it was a community of belonging identity. And so when we recognize that people in the same religious community can construct their religious identities in different ways, we see internal diversity within those communities differently. But then we also see similarities between people of different religious traditions in new ways. Often when we focus on interreligious dialogue, we're focusing on, oh, you're a Muslim and I'm a Christian and we both have an understanding of this person named Jesus. Let's talk about that. But what if our conversation about religious identity, about interreligious dialogue, didn't focus always on that content, but focused on what's important to you about being religious? If it focused on, I really care about the things that I do as a Catholic, and you really care about the things that you do as a Muslim. And even though those things that we do are different, there's something about grounding our identities in behavior that's really important that we should talk about.
Ben, what is the implication of having low religious literacy in a nation that's as diverse as ours?
We think that religious illiteracy has the potential to fuel violence. That's our operating hypothesis, and we certainly see a correlation between religious diversity, greater religious diversity, and an increase in religion-related hate crimes. And what Pew does show us is that there's lack of content knowledge, at least, about various religious traditions. So what we think is that when we teach about religion, people, at the very least, will be less susceptible to rhetoric that paints members of a specific religious community with a broad brush as a homogenous group, as all bad, as people who all, for example, support the use of violence. So one of the fascinating lessons that we've seen from this data about hate crimes is that the conventional wisdom was often that when members of a particular religious community commit acts of violence in the name of that religion, there is an increase in religion-related hate crimes against members of that community. So, for example, when someone who self-identifies as a Muslim commits an act of violence, there is an uptick of religion-related hate crimes against Muslims. And that certainly seems to be the case sort of in the shorter term. But what one research group has shown is that it's more often that hate crimes against Muslims seem to go up during election years, that there are politicians who are mobilizing their base based on a fear, a latent fear of Muslims and actually Jews. Anti-Jewish hate crime is the most prevalent form of religion-related hate crimes in the United States. And that mobilization of fear is something that is particularly possible because people don't actually know about Jews and Muslims, that if we teach people about the diversity of those communities, that if we break apart stereotypes and prejudices, they're less susceptible to that kind of mobilization.
You're at the Religious Freedom Center. This isn't just an intellectual exercise for you or something that you're curious about. It's also something that you do. What are you guys doing?
We provide training and curricular resources to educators who are interested in teaching about religion in academically rigorous and constitutionally permissible ways. So we work at the level of policy, training, and curricular resources. One thing I think a lot of Americans don't know is that there are national guidelines for teaching about religion. They're not federally mandated, they're not required, but there's an organization called the National Council for the Social Studies. It's an organization of and by social studies K-12 educators. And they've released a document called the C3 Framework, which is considered best-in-class guidelines for teaching about different social studies subjects. And in 2017, they said that of the seven fields or disciplines that were at that time part of social studies, so it was history, economics, civics, geography, anthropology, sociology, and psychology, they added an eighth. They added religious studies. And they said that well-rounded social studies education should include some education about religious studies.
Do you ever encounter resistance?
We do, but I think less than perhaps you would suspect. You know, some people are concerned that we are secretly trying to indoctrinate students, that we're secretly trying to proselytize. And then we have some people who think that we're secretly trying to make all students atheists. And that's just not the case. We're trying to equip teachers to teach about religion academically. And the good news is that there's been one study. So there's only one district in the entire country that we know of that requires all students to take a standalone religious studies course before they graduate.
Where is that?
It's in Modesto, California, which is actually a relatively conservative part of California. And in that one district, because it's the only one, researchers are quite interested. So they've gone in and they've done some studies about what happens when students go through those courses.
What did they find?
What they found is that students who went through the course did not become significantly more or less religious. So that's good news for us. So students who went through the course became more likely to recognize the rights of others, including those with whom they strongly disagree. And this is measured with a pretty common set of questions where you ask students about to think of the community that they least like. And so often people in their minds think of the KKK or other groups. And they ask them about those communities. Do they have certain basic rights or First Amendment rights? And for others, they find that students who go through these courses respect the rights of others, including those with whom they strongly disagree. This is not relativist. It is not asking whether those other groups are good. It's asking whether in a society that is structured around or that has a fact of a great deal of diversity, what are the ground rules for engaging with one another? And so that, for us, is good news that if we're teaching about religion through religious literacy education, we're not changing the religious identities of others. But for even those groups they most strongly disagree with, they recognize certain rights, which means that groups that are much more familiar to us, but maybe we don't have everyday interactions with, we respect those rights as well.
What's the implication of not taking seriously low religious literacy from a civic perspective?
I'm very fond of quoting Catholic theologian Father John Courtney Murray, who said that religious freedom doesn't necessarily have to be our articles of faith, but they're articles of peace. That in a country that we have to live with the fact of religious diversity, we don't have to agree that everyone else is equally right as us when it comes to religion. In fact, many people don't. That's not what we're asking for. But in order to live together in peace, in order to actually build a productive society in which we're able to live and work together, in which we're recognizing the most fundamental of religious freedom rights, which have to at least include the right to live and worship peacefully and in peace and not with fear of violence against us, that we have to build community that's committed to religious freedom. And at the center, we truly believe that by teaching about religion and by exposing students to the variety of perspectives within these various religious communities, we're more likely to build a citizenry that is committed to religious freedom, and that through that commitment, through understanding about religion, they're better able to protect those rights. And this is the final thing I'll say, which is that when we understand the complexity of religious identity, that religious identity is not just about the things that we believe, but also about our behaviors, about our communities of belonging, we understand religiosity in a more nuanced and rich way. And therefore, when we're protecting religious freedom rights, we're doing it in a way that recognizes the full complexity of religious identity. So, for example, when we're talking about religious freedom and all we're talking about is belief, we're not really talking about religious freedom. We're talking about freedom of conscience, about this very truncated understanding of what it means to protect religious freedom. We're just talking about the freedom to believe what we want. And everyone has that freedom, and it's hard to even say how that would be necessarily taken away, just to believe certain things. It's about that freedom of not only belief, but also about how we express that belief and how we form the communities around us. And there's a whole rich discussion. If we had another hour or day or week, we could talk about the limits of people's ability to form communities or to express their beliefs in ways that might be harmful to others. I'm not saying that it's an absolute right, just like no rights that we have in a diverse society are absolute. But it is incredibly important that if we take seriously religious freedom, we take seriously freedom to be religious in all the ways that it means to be religious.
That was Ben Marcus, religious literacy specialist with the Religious Freedom Center of the Freedom Forum Institute, a nonpartisan group based in Washington, D.C. Coming up after the break, how headlines change our views of religious groups in ways you may not realize. This is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I hope you're enjoying this week's show. I wanted to take a short break to tell you a few things about Inspired that you may not know. Our show was founded by a nun named Maureen Fiedler, who in the days after 9/11 saw a need for a national broadcast that would explore the rich diversity of beliefs among Americans. Since then, our commitment to creating and producing compelling radio has never wavered, nor has our commitment to making it available to everyone for free. No paywalls ever. But it's not free to produce this show, and we don't receive any funds from National Public Radio or the local stations that carry us. So I need to ask you for your support. If you enjoy Inspired, if you value it and count on it, please consider donating today. You can do that on our website at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. And thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.